Wonderful.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We got everybody in line? Should we start?
I think so.
I think we're here. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. So we left off. We're at Koheles 7:9. So since we haven't done it in a few weeks, let's just briefly recap this series of verses that we were doing. Okay, so he was talking about we started, I think, in 7:5 was a series of verses, and he said it was better to listen to the ridicule of an intelligent man, of a wise man, rather than to be a man who hears the song of fools. And therefore we questioned what was the necessity for him to make the statement if it was not for the fact that there is a preference not to follow this advice. And that preference, we said, comes from the fact that a person wants to have immediate gratification and also satisfaction of the ego. And we said that that's why he wants song, and he doesn't want to have his ego destroyed by being ridiculed. So he preferred to have his ego intact than to have an instant gratification of music. So that's how a person is predisposed, because we have these components. We have these psychological components, and if we don't work with them, we'll just try to cater to them. And you'll see a very nice sforno on the verse we're going to do today, which deals with this. And then he explains why this is true, that a person should really listen to the ridicule of a wise person. And he says in verse 6, he says, "For as is the sound of the crackling of the thorns underneath the pot." When a person's cooking, so he'll use thorns or things of that nature to as firewood, as something to start up the flame. And it says, those sounds that the thorns make under the fire, that is like the sound of the fool, the laughter of the fool, which is, and this is futility. So we said on that, as the commentators explain, that when the fool is just joking around, he's wasting his time, and he's actually arousing the attachment to frivolity, and he's becoming more used to something which is a waste. And just as the thorn is with the crackling sound is destroyed, so also the person, when he's just using his time jokingly, he's destroying himself. He's wasting time, and he's also exciting the instinct to in a direction that is going to affect his soul, because as the person becomes more attached to nonsense and to desires and instinctual gratification, it's much harder to remove himself from it. And as he says in the next verse, he's also prohibiting or pressing the intelligence from being engaged. So he's losing on two accounts, right? Two counts, he's now hurting himself. He's attaching himself to to foolishness, to instinctual drives. And he's also losing time that could be involved in wisdom. Okay. That's why it says in 7 that oppressing the intelligence, meaning if he restricts the use of the intelligence, he'll destroy the heart that was given as a gift. He'll destroy his the ability and also the attachment to wisdom and the waste of time. Okay. Then he gives a rule. He said it was important that, and I think, Doug, did I write this up in the Times a couple of weeks ago? Do you recall?
Which part?
I think these verses, if I'm not mistaken, if you look back maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think I actually wrote this up. So whoever, I think I went through it all. Yeah, I did. I'm trying to remember what the name of it. I'll try to recall the article. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago. So in case anybody wants to have reference to this, because I thought it was very important. And also because of the next verse, because he gives a rule now. You see, since King Solomon is concerned about the good of the people that are reading, and the person should be attached to the right life, so to tell a person, don't eat meat because it's got a cholesterol problem, so the person then may go ahead and eat cheese and eggs and chicken and things that still have the cholesterol. But if he tells the person a rule, don't eat animal products, now he can guard himself more. So that's what he's doing with the rule over here. He says, better off, we're in 7:8 now, better off is the latter end of something than its beginning. And better off is patience than pride. So you recall what we said is, now he's giving a rule. That what's the reason why this person doesn't want to hear the ridicule of the wise man? Why does he want to hear the song? Why is the person joking around a lot? Why is he restricting himself from wisdom and just wants to have instantaneous satisfaction? So he lays the rule down. Because the person is looking for the instant. He's looking for what's immediate gratification, and he also assesses something just based on his initial view of it without taking into consideration all the ramifications and actually investigating thoroughly. So because of that, people make poor decisions in many areas. Meaning being impulsive, or the phrase, haste makes waste, is a true statement. Because a person will, by definition, must ignore certain facts if he's impulsive, if he makes quick decisions. And I think I cited the cases where the Torah talks about Jacob, who heard, Joseph had the dreams, and he's telling his brothers that the stars and they're going to bow down, and the sheaves and the wheat is going to bow down to me. So Jacob heard this, and when he heard Joseph saying this, and he saw the animosity being aroused in the brothers, the jealousy, so Jacob said, really, your mother and I are going to come and bow down? Meaning, since his mother had passed away, he was trying to show that it was nonsense. So this way the brothers would not be angry with him, and they would just leave him alone. But it says at the end of that verse, but his father guarded the matter. That means Jacob, even though what he was doing was trying to damage control and try to mitigate the animosity that would be aroused by Joseph telling all his dreams of great grandeur, you're all going to bow down to me. So Jacob's approach is to disqualify it and to remove all credit from any credibility from that statement. At the same time, I believe it's right at the end of that verse, he says, but Jacob guarded the matter. That means to say what? That he did not say it wasn't true. He just wanted to have peace in the house. But at the same time, maybe there is something true over here, what Joseph was having, these dreams. And why did Jacob perhaps think this way? Because if you recall, he himself had the dream of the ladder. He understood that there is something called prophetic dreams. So maybe Joseph, who was the one he taught all of his wisdom to, Joseph was that son. That's why he made him the coat of, I'm not sure it was many colors or a striped coat, but something distinguished. He made him this beautiful jacket to show his mark of distinction, which of course aroused the animosity of the brothers too and the jealousy. But he was trying to show that Joseph was very wise, just like he put a crown on a king's head and nobody else. So he was crowning Joseph with his wisdom. So Jacob watched the matter. Meaning to say, he didn't assess immediately. Exactly what King Solomon is saying here. Don't assess something immediately. Don't be impulsive. And you see that the ridicule that Jacob actually gives to Reuben at one time after Rachel died, so he moved the bed of his mother into his... he moved the bed of Jacob into Leah's tent. So he was showing that he was being impetuous. So Jacob criticized Reuben for being, you're impetuous like water. Immediately you had a certain impulse and you acted on it. So you see the Torah bears out exactly what King Solomon is telling you over here. That better off is the latter end of something than the beginning, meaning better off to wait, to assess something fully, just like Jacob did. Although he was doing damage control by trying to remove any credibility of Joseph's dreams, at the same time the Torah says and communicates to us that he watched the matter to see what would happen. And he was right. It ended up that Joseph was having prophetic dreams. So you see how wisdom teaches a person to be patient. And that's why it's better off the latter end, because at the latter end of something, after you investigate something thoroughly and you go through the time it takes to do it, that's called the latter end. So now all the factors are in front of you. And the same thing with a person in the person's life. I think but Jacob also, again, he wasn't able to say that something was a good or a bad until the end of his life. Only once he saw how everything played out could then he say, you know, was this a good or bad? Joseph, too. He told the brothers, God sent me here to provide food during the famine. So he says, you didn't send me here. Doesn't mean he was ignoring the facts that the brothers sold him. Of course he knew that. But he was trying to tell the brothers, I don't function in a psychological way where I am concerned with competition with other people. I am concerned only with God. I see what God has done here. And my being here was really a great salvation for everybody. And that's what I'm attached to, the ultimate picture. So that's what he was telling to the brothers. So he assessed it as he saw, as matters played out. So that's what King Solomon is saying here. And that's what he says at the end of the verse. And he said this also. Why does he just, he could stop right there and just say, better is the beginning, is better is the latter end than the beginning. End the verse right there and then go on and say the next thing, which is better off is patience than pride. But we said he includes it in this very verse because when he's talking about the rule, so essential to following this rule of valuing the latter end of something and then in the beginning is the very character trait of patience. So he's trying to show there's an intimate relationship between following this rule and a certain personality. That's therefore King Solomon puts it together. It's in one verse to show you there's an intimate relationship. As Rebbe Trade explained, whenever you have a number of ideas in a single verse, they're more intimately related than if they're in separate verses, or certainly if they're in separate chapters. And I don't mean chapters in terms of the numbers that we have, which the Gentiles made. I'm talking about the Torah has gaps. If you look at the Torah, you'll see that there are gaps where there's no letters to show the reader, okay, this is the end of a subject matter, and now a new subject matter is beginning. So there's a number of ways to know in the Torah when something is related, if there's a separation of letters, or even more intimately, if there's a number of ideas in one verse. So we saw here in this verse that together with the rule that he lays down to always assess things at the end, to get the full picture and get all the facts before you make a decision, so dependent is this on patience that he puts that advice of being patient in this same verse. Okay? Okay, so that brings us to the verse that we're up to now, the new verse. I think we touched on it, but now we'll analyze it. So far, so good?
Not here.
Okay. Okay, so now it says the next verse, 7:9. And he says, Al tevahel brucha, don't be excited in your spirit to be angry, because anger is something which sits in the bosom of the fool. Anger is something which rests in the bosom of a fool. Don't be excited in your spirit to be angry, to display anger. For anger is something which rests very close to the heart, in the bosom, meaning close to the heart of a fool. Okay, I'll let you think about that and tell me what you notice about it. And what is, I mean, I'll leave it to you. I'll follow your guide. That's a good
question. The way you were reading it, I wondered if it was you were saying in the middle of it, commanding you to be angry.
No. I'll read it again. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. Do not be excited in your spirit to become angry, because anger rests in the bosom of fools.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I didn't miss it.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he means when one becomes angry, they're not thinking clearly. The emotions are overcoming their good sense. And then they become foolish. They do foolish things. They're not thinking clearly. They're not being rational.
Okay.
I second that.
Thank you.
The fool is angry quickly, it's saying here, right? So he doesn't understand, Fidab. He hasn't taken time to investigate the matter over which he's angry. He's angry before he has all the facts. And if he understood them, he might know that there was nothing about which to be angry.
Okay, so you're saying it's an application of the previous verse.
It kind of seems like it's me.
Yes, I agree. Anybody else want to make any comments or questions on that?
Does that make sense?
Okay, so he's saying that. So let's isolate the elements now in the verse. So the elements in the verse are, as a new point, don't become excited. And then he says, what is the part of you that should not become excited? Your ruach, your spirit. All right, I think we said earlier, if you remember 7:3, we talked about the ruach being the ego. Right, the arrogance of the person. And he says, and you shouldn't use that in order to express anger. So he's telling you an interesting thing, that arrogance and anger are related. Okay, if we could just look at the structure of the verse. So he says there is something called arrogance. There is a spear of the person, the haughtiness. That's the thing which wants to have rulership. And then he says, what's the reason why you shouldn't do it? He gives in a reason. Because anger rests in the bosom of the fool. What does it mean, it rests? What about that word? What do you mean that it rests? Why does it just say, because fools get angry? Don't be like a fool. And what is so foolish about becoming angry? We have to ask that too, don't we? What is so foolish about becoming angry? So I think Jim already touched on that by saying, well, if you're angry at things, you may not size it up, and then you're going to fail at the advice that King Solomon gave in the previous verse. That means wait, be patient, analyze something.
Right.
Okay, but what is this idea? So a number of things. Excitement. And it's with the... And what's the relationship between arrogance and anger? And why, of all things, is he picking this as the example? It seems to be he just gave the rule, but now, after he gives the rule, you see what he's doing just in terms of his method. And that's what we're trying to do throughout the whole book, and what we have to do in every time we learn is to see, understand the sequence, what's going on, what is he trying to do. So you see how he laid down certain principles, he showed how people behave, and then he gives a rule in 8, and then 9, now he gives application. The application, where he gives an act of restraint. Meaning to say, now that he told you to be patient, so that's why he comes in and he shows you an act that will demonstrate this type of patience. Don't be excited, because evidently there is this part of the person that he gets excited. Excited is something that is aroused through arrogance, though. Meaning to say that something is going against how you would like it to go. Something's not going your way. So all of a sudden, the knee-jerk reaction is going to be that the person will get excited. He's got to stop it. He's got to attempt to put things back on track. And Bilam was on the path. He was trying to curse the Jews. The donkey is going off the path. So Bilam hits the donkey. right? The arrogance just is immediately responds, knee-jerk reaction. And that's what anger is. Anger, like Rabbi Chaim explained, is, I think, quoting the rabbis, that it's akin to idolatry. Because he explained that idolatry is where a person is distorting reality. And when a person's angry, it's an expression of intolerance of what the current reality is giving him. He just bought a new car, and he pulls it out of a lot, and somebody rear-ends him, and now it makes this huge dent. Oh, he was just in the middle of the peak of his fantasy of that car, and now he just completely ruins it, and he doesn't accept it. I think I may have mentioned an example once that Rabbi Chaim had cited, where there was a rabbi at his table with all of his notes, and he had a cup of tea, and he was going through his notes, and somebody sat down at the table, shook the table, spilled the tea, ruined all the notes. And the rabbi stood up quickly, and then he sat down. Meaning, many times an emotion overtakes us, but he's always a person who's an intelligent person, sees his actions, sees what's going on, and accepted the fact the notes are gone, that's it, sat back down. He didn't blurt out anything. There was an initial, you know, he did the labor and all the hours and to write down his ideas and what he really valued the most. So initially, sometimes the emotion does overtake us. Maybe in some other case, that he would go onto the notes and the person would look at it, and he wouldn't even have to stand up because he was even more perfected. There would be no physical expression whatsoever. But understanding that it's gone, he accepted the reality and he sat down. But anger is the same way. It's the same thing as idolatry. You're trying to distort reality into, I can't take this right now. I'm going to express my anger. And you start yelling at somebody for what they did as if that's going to change history, which it can't. If something took place, it took place. And of course, you could be, you know, remedial. You can try to remedy the situation if possible. So that's the right approach. But if nothing can be done, so acceptance is the best thing to move forward. All right? And as I'm talking, I now have an answer to a question I had earlier because I was looking at the next verse. It says, don't say, you know, the person is longing for the days, you know, the good old times. And they were better than these. He says, don't say this. Because you did not ask this out of wisdom. So why is that coming next?
Rabbi, I don't understand what you're saying.
Take a look at the next verse, verse 10. Why is that following verse 9?
Is it because if we're talking about evaluating something after the end, and then because life goes up and down and you ask this question, maybe your circumstances are not so great, you look back when times are better, but because it's not, I don't know, you're prompted to ask that question while you're probably feeling emotionally not so great.
Exactly. Living in the past, I think he's saying, right? Like, you're not feeling so
or
great.
Not living in...
What's that?
Or maybe living in the moment where your present situation isn't as great as it was in the past.
Right.
So, I guess, yeah.
So it sounds like when like you're saying, that the person will try to think about what happened in the past, so it gives him some solace. It gives him some... Or he's trying to remove himself from the present, but he's not living in reality. Meaning it's following what we just said, because you tell me if this is what you're saying, because the person who's angry, he can't tolerate the present. So he's trying to change it. And what a person may do as another expression of that is to, like you're saying, when he's not happy in the moment, so he looks for something which is more comforting than in his previous time, right?
Right.
So that's another expression of where he's going with this verse. Because otherwise, it seems to be like so out of place. He's talking about not being excited and not you know, arousing, the, not using arrogance to act out a certain anger. Because anger is when you feel it should, I'm the center. This should not be this way. What I want is really the most important thing. That comes from arrogance. That doesn't come from the fact that the person studied, the person looked at all the factors right now. If he knew that there was a guy that was drinking as he was pulling his new car out of the lot, it has to be that the guy who's drinking is going to ram right into you. Unfortunately, you didn't know that at the time, so you can't really prevent every single thing in life, but the anger shouldn't be there, because if a person is really objective, he'll understand. These are all the factors that were in play. This had to happen. A guy builds a house on a mountain where there's a tremendous amount of rain all the time. He's going to have a mudslide occasionally that's going to, you know, maybe get into the house or even knock the house over. The guy, you know, then that should be something which is, that's why a person doesn't build his house on the side of a mountain. But what we're saying over here again is that do not be excited with your spirit to be angry, because again, that's going against the advice of being patient. That's what the excitement is. He's pointing out that it's arrogance. So arrogance is something which when a person is looking just to satisfy himself as opposed to looking outside, meaning there's a person trying to just be like he projects his desires onto reality and tries to force reality to jive with him. So that's, like Rabbi Chaid explained, is the sign of a wicked person. The wicked person is trying to conform reality to his wishes. But if a person is like a scientist, he wants to conform himself to reality. Let me understand how reality works. This is real. There's no changing that. So let me work within reality. If making money is going to happen when I sell something more, for more than what I pay for it, that's the right way to make a living. If a person tries to sell it for less, of course, it's foolish, and he's going to lose money. So he has to work with how reality operates. He sees it gets cold, he buys warmer clothing. So he works with reality. But the person who looks at himself as the center, he's arrogant, and he gets angry at things as an expression that he can't tolerate it. And what will happen again, is that's what we're saying in 10, is that King Solomon says, don't long for the days past where you think they were better. So why not? You see, you're not asking this from wisdom. What do you mean you're not asking it from wisdom? So we'll come to that kind of question in a second. Let's just finish off 9, but let me see if there's any questions before I finish off 9. I want to take up the point now about what does it mean that anger rests in the bosom of the fools? What is he telling me that for? So before we start that, let's see if we have the first part of 9 clear.
Rabbi, I was just thinking that all of these things take a person away from reality.
Yeah, go ahead, Hal.
Well, anger takes you out of reality because you think that the world should conform to what you think it should be. And arrogance is...
I didn't hear you get cut off. Can you say that again?
From the beginning?
No, the first thing I got, that you said that anger takes you out of reality. That I got.
Right, and arrogance is the same way.
True. So all these you're saying are distortions of reality.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. That's good, because these are things which he says a fool does, and the fool is the person who, I mean, foolish means that you're fooling yourself. It's false. So you're right, Cal. Now, what does he mean to tell us further that anger sits in the bosom of the fool?
Rabbi?
Yes.
Because it's always ready to leap out. The fool is a foolish person can be provoked very easily, and the anger is sitting there waiting to erupt.
Right. That's exactly what Sforno says. I'll read it to you.
Okay.
Sforno says as follows. He says, "Do not be easy to become angry, because anger rests in the bosom of fools, prepared in their chest, and ready, and apparent, transparent to everybody. without the ability to restrain it. And these type of people, they're drawn after any mood swings, he says. Any type of a change in their mood, they're drawn after this, as their nature is. Without any ability to focus onto proper type of objectives. So he says exactly like you said.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is it also kind of saying, like we talked about in class, how you want to address the emotions right away when something happens, because once they get a hold of you, they're a lot harder to, to subdue?
That's true. We discussed that?
I thought we did.
Yeah, that's something which actually is a verse in Genesis. It talks about the snake, when God tells... He's addressing the snake, and he says, the man will step on your head, but you'll bite his heel. So there the Sforno says, you take a look at it, it's a very nice parallel to how the instincts work. He says that also is a metaphor for how instincts work. If man steps on the head of the snake, meaning if man, the head means the beginning also. So if the man, as soon as the emotion flares up, he gets it right at the beginning, like you're saying, Francesca. So if he gets it right at the beginning, that's when he can conquer it. He'll be stronger. But if he allows it to swell up, so then the snake will get his heel. That means to say the instincts will get man at the end, the heel of the battle. If man goes with the emotion, he doesn't conquer right away, so then the emotion is going to overtake him, because that's going to have the upper hand. That's where the emotion is stronger. So that's actually what the Sforno says on that verse in Genesis. It's in chapter 3. Okay. So, right, and like you're saying, Richter, that the if you keep the emotion, if you keep the anger, and your person acts it out, so it's right in the chest, it's like always ready to leap out without any restraint. So that's what he means over here. Underlines the idea of something that is going unchecked, and you're not in control of it. You act it out right away. You're impetuous, impulsive. That's what he's dealing with over here, and again, that's what he brings us as an example. And perhaps he uses the example of anger as his illustration of better off his patience than pride, because this is really where, like we said, patience and pride are more intimately related to the ability of a person to just, wait, take, step back, don't act abruptly or impulsively, take in all the facts, take some time, think things over before you actually make an assessment and then make a decision. But what's going to help that is the trait of patience, and what's going to hurt that is pride. That's why it says, better off is patience than pride at the end of verse 8. Because pride is really the antithesis of a person's being able to be cool, calm, and collected, to be able to observe objectively. So he uses that very example and tells you, now apply it and don't leap before you look. All right, and like Cal, you're saying, to your point, that these things take a person out of reality. That's why he's telling you that if you do this, then you're going to be a fool. Because foolishness means where you're denying reality. Right? You fool yourself as to what is real. That's what fool, that's what a fool is. Okay. Now, I didn't prepare the next verse, but let's see if we can tackle it. Like we said, now let me see if there's any questions or comments up to this point. Okay. All right, so why don't we take a minute or two, take a look at the next verse. And for those of you who don't have it, I'll read it, and then just think about it. And then we'll actually see if you have commentators on that also. I'll read it one more time. Do not say, how good were the earlier days? Meaning, did I say, actually, Doug, do you have that? Let me hear how your translation is.
actually, Rabbi, he's driving in the car right now, but he's listening in on his cell phone.
Oh, okay.
Cal, the book is on my desk.
Okay.
It's the red one.
That's what I call a dedicated Torah student.
Yes. Thank you.
I hope you don't do the opposite. Like if you're leaving a party and you take a six pack with you in the car, I don't want you to be that dedicated to things that you're missing. I'm going to keep you around a little bit longer here.
So that wouldn't be a correct application of this lesson?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
I guess I'll have to revise my playbook. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to stick it back in the bookshelf, but I haven't.
Right, so I'll just read it from here. Unless somebody else has the English. Anybody else online have the English?
I do.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Do not say, how was the former days were better than these? For not out of wisdom have you asked concerning them.
Okay, so we had it right. Good. So he says here, do not say, what of what was? That the first days, the former days, were better than these, because you have not asked us from wisdom. Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, just one second.
Okay.
I'm sorry, like I said, I didn't prepare this. I'm just looking over and just looking at some of the commentators for a minute.
No, it's okay. I've just been hearing sound. I thought I lost the connection.
Oh, okay, no.
It's fine.
Like I was suggesting earlier, I think he may be saying this because it follows on the behavior of somebody who is intolerant of reality. So an expression of that is living in the past, which of course is foolish because it's then you're not even living. That's not actually what your circumstances are. So let's take a look at the commentators. Yeah, Jim, you wanted to say something?
I'm sorry. Yes, I was just going to say that this is just a statement of discontentment, and that's why there's no wisdom. This isn't that he's not objectively studying reality to determine, you know, that there were former times better than these. He's merely, you know, kicking his knee out, you know, in anger.
Very well said. Very good. Meaning he's not doing a study over here. He's not applying his mind to understand something, but he's doing the opposite. He's projecting. He's just expressing anguish or expressing of an emotion, which doesn't do anything. The person just outlets the emotion. It's not working with reality, so it's not wise, and he's not analyzing. Again, he's not being wise. Right. Very well said, Jim.
Yeah, Rabbi, I would say too, this person is not really living in the past, probably, but you know, he's thinking of like a fantasy of the past, not even the actual past.
I mean, he's actually distorting it, and he's selectively thinking about good things when really they weren't so good.
Right.
Right.
So it's not even a reality of the past that he's living in it. It's just it's a fantasy.
Excellent.
Yeah, and Tina wrote on screen that would the verse mean that when you look back at former days, you remember how something made you feel, and you don't look at them with rationality? That also could be true, Tina. Yeah, that could also be true. That you're not looking rationally in the past. Let's take a look at Rashi, and then we'll look at Sforno, and then maybe Ibn Ezra. So Rashi says, don't say, how the days in the past were so good. He says, don't be wondrous on the good that happened to the righteous people in the early generations, like the generation of the desert, and the generation of Joshua, and the generation of David. And he says, why not? It's because all that was done, all the good that they had, was based on the merit of those generations. Okay, that's Rashi. So he's saying that it really is up to the person. If you're looking back when the Jews had great times, so it's in the person's hands to do that. It's in the person's hands that if they have a good generation and the leaders get together and try to benefit the generation, so then they'll also enjoy that. What does Sforno says? What does Sforno say? He says, don't get angry on the way the world was operating. That good things were happening to early generations, and that type of good was not being applied to latter generations, similar to Rashi. But he says, don't say this. Why not? What's Sforno's angle? He says, because you're not asking this out of wisdom. Why? Because there's no doubt that there has been no change in terms of how God relates to the world. Don't think that time itself is the consideration. Because if people are equally good in current generations, they'll have the equal good from God. So saying that a person is looking at old times as being, oh, it was an error. It was something about the error. So he's looking at the wrong thing. Time itself is not what makes or breaks, the good or the evil that a generation experiences. So it's similar to Rashi. Okay. Let's see. One second. Right. Yeah, Ibn Ezra says similarly. He says that the person who's wise will know that the days are all equal. Nothing has changed before and after. It all has to do with the portion that each person gets. Okay, go ahead, Francesca.
Yeah, I just had a question. Is it possible to look objectively on the past and say, well, that really was actually good? In a real way, or I'm just curious.
Yeah, of course. A person is a normal person could definitely have a clear recollection. A person is being objective.
Okay, we're just talking about a certain perspective of a certain person with a flaw in their philosophy, I guess.
Yeah, they're saying that the older days were better. There was something better about the days. And they're not realizing that it's not, they're trying to make a statement that it's, there's a lack of equality in previous times as the current times. And the commentators are saying that's not true. In terms of how the world works and how God set up things, those are fixed laws. The person here is making a mistake. And he thinks there's something about those times. So he's not asking it out of wisdom. He really has not looked at reality. Like Jim said, he's not, if he studied, he'd realize natural law hasn't changed. The way God works, it says in Malachi, in the last of the prophets, it says, I am God, I do not change, which makes sense, because God is perfect, and anything which is perfect that would change, that means it has to change to an imperfect state. Any change in something perfect must make it less perfect. So that's the principle that I'm God, I do not change, meaning I work in a perfect way and there is no change. But the person is lamenting, evidently he's got a skewed value system, and he's maybe making an assessment that something is bad right now, and instead of trying to get himself out of it, or maybe he's got a wrong assessment. Maybe something is not so bad right now. But he's looking for the wrong things, and that's why he's finding himself frustrated. If he'd look for the right things, he may look around and see, you know, I do have everything I need. And if I want to try to keep up with the Joneses and get that fancy car that my next door neighbor just got, maybe it's going to cause me to work twice as hard as I am now, and I won't have the free time to be with my family. So the person can make a lot of be led astray by a lot of desires that, you know, society, you know, tells us we have to have. But if a person's independent and he thinks for himself and has the right values, so he could really live with very, very little and be very, very happy and not be concerned with trying to have greatness and trying to have power and trying to be the center of attention all the time. And it's, these are things which we're led astray, that it makes, you know, society tells us this will give us great happiness and so on and so forth. But in fact, we know this, that the happiest we are is when we're, hey, we learned something new, we enjoyed, you know, a new idea, and, you know, simpler pleasures and things that are not distracting us or taking us away from, you know, what's of great value, and keeping our focus that, you know, this life is temporary, and that really perfecting ourselves in order to get, really have an existence that's eternal, that's really should be the focus. And anything that takes the person away from that, that he doesn't want to get involved in. Somebody had a question?
Yes, I just wanted to add one thing, Rabbi. People, when they look back, they tend to look at things in different events, but they don't see the whole picture. They don't see the bad times. They don't see everything. They can't possibly remember everything that occurred. It was difficult then also. There were difficult times as well as good times. They're not balancing it properly. When they look back, when they're sad in the present, when they look back, they're looking at things in the past. They just take a little pieces to try to make themselves feel that it's better than, and that makes them feel even worse. Sometimes people do that.
Yep, that's true.
They look to get the word I'm looking for. Reassures them that they're thinking properly, but they're really not. They're not looking at the whole picture.
Yep. People do that in the present too.
Yeah, and we do that in the present also. We're not, because that's the foolishness. That's how a fool. Fool does not think clearly. A fool takes pieces. They don't look at the whole picture. It's the same way as when they're arrogant, they jump. And they become angry immediately. It's just waiting to jump out.
Right.
Because they're not listening to the whole thing. They're not looking at the whole picture and evaluating it. They're not taking the time. They absolutely have no patience, which you were saying before. And it's very true.
Forget some of the pain of childbirth after the event occurs. there's the situation where the Israelites said, oh, that we could go back to the, you know, the leeks and the onions and the garlic we had in Egypt. You know, that remembering of the past in a way that somehow makes it better than it actually was.
That's a good quote. That's right. Where they remembering instead of we remember the leeks and the onions and the garlic and that we and the fish that we ate for free. So Rashi comments over there. I think it's Rashi, and he says, "What do you mean? They didn't get straw for free. You think the Egyptians are going to give them fish for free?" So Rashi says, "No. What it means free." Is that whatever they had back in Egypt, they were free from doing the commands. They didn't have the Torah yet. Once they had the Torah, it now presented a big stress on them. All these laws that they had to do. And they wanted to be released. There's another case in the Torah where it says, once they get the laws, and they used to be able to marry and have intercourse with their family members. There was no prohibition. So now that they were prohibited in that, it says they were crying. Because now they felt restricted in that sense, and I'm not sure if it was Maimonides or somebody who says that their family members, like your sisters, you know, your parents, the closest ones that you're related to, those are the ones you're restricted in terms of having intercourse with, because they're the ones that would be most readily found, and then you'll be involved in intercourse all day, and you won't be living a life of wisdom. So that actually, it's a help. Today, people will say to themselves, oh, I can't even, you know, stomach the idea of having intercourse with my sister or my mother. But the Torah says just the opposite. In Talmud Brachos, it says that if a person has a dream of intercourse with his mother or intercourse with his sister, so that person should anticipate wisdom, meaning that if a person is that unrepressed, that they can have a dream about the first female figures that they had in their life, and that naturally is going to have a certain pull sexually. So if a person is able to have dreams about that, that means that they're so unrepressed, they will become very wise people. So we see how the Torah looks at things objectively, and that, you know, today it's only a taboo that a person says, oh, you know, I can't, you know, think about the idea of sexual relations with a family member. That's a society, or just the fact that it's so ingrained that it's off limits, it becomes a taboo. Or people will say, like, you know, oh, you know, pork must be disgusting. The truth is, the Talmud says, don't say it's disgusting. If it's really good, say it's good. It smells great, but I can't eat it because it's prohibited. The Torah says I can't. But don't be foolish. Don't say something which is false. So, you know, in this getting back, coming, you know, around to your point, Doug, yes, that's Rivka's point, that a person will filter out and they'll recall things in a different way, and they'll make it out to be different than what they really experienced because of the pain of the current situation. They're forcing themselves into some sort of a comfort. Really, that's just an escapist attitude. What a person should really do if they're in a situation that's it's not a pleasant situation for any reason. Use wisdom to extricate yourself. Plan an exit strategy, as they say. Okay.
Yeah, Barry.
Yeah.
I just comment to Doug. I think what he said was beautiful. It is so true. We forget the pain. We forget how the Jews forgot what they went through in Egypt, and they wanted to go back because it was familiar to them. They were afraid of the fear of the future, anticipatory anxiety, I guess you'd call it. But that was an excellent review of what we were learning.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, just about done. Any questions or comments before we wrap it up for today?
I have a question, but it's not about this.
All right, go ahead. Unless somebody else unless somebody else has a question on the topic. If not, go ahead, Jim. All right, Jim, go ahead.
The word for creation in Genesis 1:1 doesn't mean creation or creating so much as organizing. I was wondering, I don't know Hebrew, so I was wondering if you could either correct that or explain it or something.
Okay. Let me see. I think that Maimonides may take that up. Hold on. All right, Jim, let me look that up and get back to you on that. I thought that he had that in the beginning, but I'm wrong. I don't see him. I thought I remember reading it. I'm not sure where exactly that is. That the term of bara, to create, if that means, because we definitely held of creation from nothing. But when it says that he made the heavens and earth, in the beginning God made the heavens and earth, so I'll have to see where he talks about that. Does that mean forming what exists, or does that mean something from nothing? But was there a second part of your question?
Yes, the person was saying basically what you just said, that they were arguing the other side. They said that God did not create ex nihilo, and that, they're Mormons, so they're arguing that he was just a great scientist. But since I don't know the Hebrew, I can't discuss that word in particular without some understanding.
Because the term is used like in terms of, like it says, God created darkness. So darkness is not a real thing. It's the absence of light. So how do you say God created darkness? It says he formed light and he created. Formed means that he took matter and made it into a luminary. He made it the sun. He made the stars. So that could be that it could be explained that it's attributable to him. Something he did now resulted in darkness. Even though darkness itself is not a real thing, it's just the absence of light. But let me see if I can locate where that was. I know he speaks about it. I'll have to get back to you on that. All right,
Rabbi. The guy from Perplexed, the Friedlander translation, I think it's like page 265.
Oh yeah, I got it right here, 265.
Somewhere in that area.
Which chapter is that?
Chapter 9. I think it's listed book 2, chapter 9. Unless it's book 3, I'm not sure. Just as we say of him who puts out the light at night that he has produced darkness, so we say of him who destroyed the sight of any being that he produced blindness. Although darkness and blindness are negative properties and require no agent, I mean, they're just a lack, they're a state of privation, which means that it's not something positive. In accordance with this view, we explain the following passage of Isaiah. Quote, I form the light and create darkness. There we go. Very good. How'd you find this so fast, Josh?
What's that?
How'd you find this so fast?
I looked in the table of contents.
Oh. Okay, I guess I missed it. Make me look bad. Thanks a lot. Okay. All right, so what does he say? He says, similarly, we explain the following passage of Isaiah. Quote, I form the light and create bore, darkness. The same word that God says he created the heavens and earth, which is bore. So he says here also, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. For darkness and evil, so now my mind just continues. Darkness and evil are non-existing things. Consider that the prophet does not say, I make darkness, I make evil, because darkness and evil are not things in a positive existence to which the verb to make will apply. The verb bara, he created, is used because Hebrew, this verb is applied to non-existing things. And now he goes to Genesis, and he says, in the beginning God created, bara, he created the heavens and earth. Here, the creation took place from nothing. Only in this sense can non-existence be said to be produced by a certain action of an agent. So he's saying what? That bara, the Hebrew word bara, is used in Genesis. And he says, here the creation took place from nothing. Only in this sense can non-existence be said to be produced by a certain action of an agent. Let me just see, 1 second. It seems to be what he's saying is just like the creation of darkness is really the elimination of light. So you're not actively creating darkness. Like if I create a building, then I am acting on bricks and cement, right? So I'm acting on something positive. There's a positive relationship to a real thing. So there we would say oseh, because now I'm making something. I'm acting on physical objects. But if I create darkness by putting out a light, there the word bara is used, because bara is relating to something which is not in existence. So Maimonides says that's why God used the term bara in Genesis, when it says he created the heavens and earth, because he was there was a relationship to non-existence. There was nothing in existence yet, so in order to indicate that everything came from non-existence, it says God created bara. He uses the word which in the opposite direction, where you create darkness, you're acting on something which doesn't exist. So he wanted to equate that and show that Genesis is also when God acted on something which was not in existence. All right, Jim?
Okay.
So it was creation from nothingness. Okay. All right, Josh, thanks.
Yes,
yeah, basically, if there's no light, that creates the darkness. And if there's no peace, that creates the evil. There's no kindness, that creates evil.
Right.
Okay. It's not as if God created the evil and the darkness. It just came about because of a lack of the other things.
Right.
The kindness and the light.
Right.
I think, too, doesn't it, when he makes the woman, like out of Adam's side or whatever it's said, the word there is not bara. I'm not sure what it is. They formed. Not that it's not creation from nothing there. So that's it. I don't know if that's the word.
Let's take a look. Good point.
And where it was, yeah.
It says, he built the woman. Right. It's 2:22. God built the side of the man into a woman. So that's consistent. Very good. Doesn't say he created, because he can't. There was already something positive in existence. So building, that makes sense, because you're acting on something which exists already, and you're changing its form. But to bring something into existence from non-existence, now God is acting upon non-existence. So that's where the word bara is used. Okay. All right, any other questions?
Oh, this is all so interesting.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way, that the woman was built. I kept thinking it's man created, Hashem, God created man and woman. But it's true with the rib. That makes sense.
Right. There's a psychological reason behind that, too. I think Rabbi Chaid explained that. That was necessary, that man would now... There's a medrash that says that man had intercourse with all the animals, and he was not satisfied. So now, why was he satisfied all of a sudden with woman? Because the woman was from him, and that's why he said, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. It was necessary that man identified with the woman. So it was part of him. So the other animals were not part of him. They were separate creations.
Uh-huh.
So here it was necessary that God, to get the satisfaction that the person needs, to identify with his mate, so therefore it had to be part of him.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
All right. All right, so we'll wrap it up. We'll wrap it up here, and we'll pick up next week. All right.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Good week, everybody.
You will.